ready to watch. Good television and movies are a conduit to other worlds, experiences, and lives. A fictional little boy with superpowers, or a lonely teenage girl, or a rich family 1,000 miles away. Immersing yourself in their universe via Netflix binge can transport you not only mentally, but also emotionally. There is also catharsis in watching bad television, which can provide the healing magic of putting yourself not just elsewhere, but nowhere. Because although spells and witchcraft may be all about stimulating the brain, sometimes you just want your brain to turn off. The trick, however, is to watch without judgment. Society puts so much pressure on us to be constantly productive. Even our time to ourselves is supposed to be mentally or physically stimulating. A ritual is the perfect way to create the accepting space needed for this ultimate disappearing act. Sit cross-legged and throw a blanket over your head so your whole body is completely covered. Close your eyes and envision the blanket slowly turning into a warm, golden ball of light. Then begin to hum, imagining all your stress, guilt, or other concerns emanating from your body and into the golden ball, where they break apart and disappear. As the stress leaves your body, envision the golden light entering, filling you up and making every cell radiate. Take stock of your emotions. Would a sad movie make you feel sadder, or do you want to revel in those feelings? Do you want the comfort of watching a show you've seen 12 times, or are you ready to try something new? When you feel like you have a good sense of what you want to watch, emerge from the blanket and take a bite of your snack. You are now ready to start watching. Chapter 4. Summoning. The power to care for others. We think of the witch as a solitary creature. She lives alone on the edge of town in a ragged house surrounded by weeds, emerging only at night, happily separated from other living beings, save maybe a cat or a newt. But nothing could be further from the truth. Witches love to travel in packs, or, as we call them, covens. Finding a group of like-minded people to share your feelings, passions, and powers with is not something that happens all of a sudden. There's not a store where you can just pick up a set of friends, though there are apps, which is sort of the same. Cultivating a strong social circle is an active process. Your coven isn't just the group of people who happen to show up in the same places as you do, but the people you've chosen to devote part of your heart and mind and schedule to. You will not always agree with them. You may not always understand the decisions they make. They will not always make you happy, though if they're making you miserable, you may want to reevaluate. But in the end, they are the people you show up for. Covens aren't necessarily intuitive, either. Many people like to have a best friend, but there's more to your coven than your favorite closest pal. The people you choose to join you will have different purposes at different times. Sometimes your energies will be synced with one person more than others, and sometimes others won't be as connected to one another as they are to you. But your coven is your team. Together, you're greater than any one, or even any two, of you alone. In this chapter, we'll talk about seeking out and evaluating potential friends, navigating jealousy and competitiveness, healing conflicts, and joining forces with the weird sisters who recognize your powers. Maintaining a coven requires selflessness, compromise, and deep empathy. But when done right, all of that energy is reciprocal and comes back many times over. If these are the people you show up for, they are also the people who will show up for you, at your best and at your worst, however you grow and change. No matter what happens, they will be there for you, ready to strip and dance naked in the woods. How to build a coven. Good coven building relies on one of the core pillars of many witchcraft practices, the Rule of Threes, also known as the Threefold Law or the Law of Return. Basically, whatever energy you put into the world, you will receive in return 3 times stronger. This rule is good to keep in mind no matter what you're doing, but especially when making friends. Everyone understands that if you're a thoughtful, caring person, you tend to attract thoughtful, caring people. And if you're mean and vindictive, it'll eventually come around to bite you in the ass. But the rule of threes adds an urgency to that common knowledge. When building a coven, the rule of threes applies not just to energy, but actual people. If you lie about who you are and don't treat the people in your life well, you may soon find yourself surrounded by people treating you 3 times worse than you ever treated anyone. Or worse, surrounded by no one at all. Start with your present coven. Because you're old enough to read a book independently, you've likely lived long enough to pick up a few friends. If these friends have been close and cool and loyal from day one, and you can share your deepest feelings and fears with them, then fantastic. Keep doing what you're doing. However, maybe you're not comfortable with the friends you have right now. That happened to Jaya in middle school. Her group of friends said they loved her, but put her down for her appearance, weight, interests, and basically anything else they could pick on. She was afraid to tell them she was hurt, felt pressured to do what they told her, and never really felt like they would be there for her in a crisis. But she ignored those feelings because they were her friends. They had been around for years, and starting over seemed scary. Salvation came in the form of a new school, summer camp, and a group of people who accepted Jaya for her complete weird self. But it also came as Jaya began to realize what made her her. This included surface stuff like music tastes and fashion choices, but also her particular way of looking at the world. In terms of the rule of three, it's not just good energy, but your own unique energy that brings back good returns in the form of others who truly understand you. If you're getting back nothing but negative vibes, you may be wasting your aura on the wrong crowd. Being yourself isn't just a statement or a boost for your self-esteem. It's literally attractive. It brings people toward you. Find where they're hiding. Because friendships often begin with shared interests, spend time in places and doing activities you enjoy. You could meet a potential new coven mate at a play or at a concert, on a sports team or in a hiking club, or at a Magic the Gathering competition at your local comic book store. Surface interests often correlate with deeper similarities. If you're not the club-joining type, identify someone in your life who seems cool that you want to get to know better. All good relationships balance self-acceptance and growth, after all. A truly powerful bond will leave you feeling as comfortable as possible with yourself, because no one feels comfortable with themselves 100% of the time, but also open to change. Good friends won't ask you to apologize for the things you love and will lead you to new things you don't know you love yet. Practice patience. Assembling a coven doesn't happen overnight. You won't show up on the first day of volleyball practice and walk away with a new best friend for life. In fact, one of the best pieces of advice Jaya was given when headed off to college was not to try to make friends, which seems counterintuitive. The logic went that, especially in a dorm room setting, making fast friends is easy, and fast friends are okay. But if you can slowly get to know people, quality connections will reveal themselves. It totally worked. Divining who is truly coven-worthy takes time. If hanging out with someone leaves you feeling powered up, excited, or relaxed, that's a strong sign that this person is compatible. If afterward you're drained, anxious, or even bored, they might be sapping you of strength instead. Be bold. Asking someone to get closer to you can be scary, like asking someone on a date. But if you have the courage to take that risk, your effort will be returned to you threefold. The easiest way to bridge the gap is to move forward. Ask them to hang out, invite them places you're going, get their number, and start texting them. Pay attention to how they react to your advances. Tune in very carefully to their energy and use it to bolster your own feelings of friendship and connection. Even if the friendship doesn't become super close, super fast, you'll have increased your powers of self-confidence simply by putting them into practice. Don't curse your chances. If you've been less than perfect in your past relationships, whether you were your high school's mean girl or a total outcast, you're not doomed to be lonely forever. You can still find a stronger, more nurturing community whenever you're ready to seek it out. Tap deep into your psyche and become especially aware of your actions. How are you treating people? Are you being there for them like you want them to be there for you? If what you're doing came back to you threefold, how would you feel? Most importantly, you must trust in your magic. Insecurity over making friends often stems from fear that you have nothing to offer, that no one would want to join your coven. But people are out there who match your magic, and they will not only value it, but be energized by it. Sharing and affirming the essence of who you are may take time, and it may take work, but it is always worth it. Witch History. The Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. On Halloween morning, 1968, 13 women dressed as witches marched toward the New York Stock Exchange, dancing, singing, and carrying a papier-mâché pig's head on a platter. After telling security that they had an appointment with the boss, Satan, the women made their way to the trading floor, where they hexed the entire enterprise. The market closed that day 1.5 points down and dropped a further 5 points the next day. This group of activists, known as the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, get it, was active only for a few years in the late 1960s, but in that time it used magic and mischief to protest capitalism, patriarchal beauty standards, and the institution of marriage. The first WITCH coven was founded by New York City feminists who found local activism too serious and not mischievous enough, and soon sister covens popped up in other cities. These 13-member groups would get together to cast hexes on symbols of oppression, ranging from the presidential inauguration to beauty pageants to the Chicago Transit Authority after a fare hike. Their approach was certainly radical at the time, but in many ways, the tactics of WITCH seem almost embarrassingly retro now. The group's manifesto talks about gypsies, a term now understood to be a racist slur against the Romani people. It attacked women for participating in the sexist system of marriage. The New York coven infiltrated a bridal show held in Madison Square Garden, chanting, "Here come the slaves, off to their graves," and papering the city with stickers saying, "Confront the whore makers at the bridal fair." Although original member Robin Morgan wrote in her 1977 book, Going Too Far, The Personal Chronicle of a Feminist, "We thought it would be clear that this time we were blaming the men who forced women into the institution of marriage, not pillorying the women. We might have realized that brides-to-be don't like being called whores." Of course, even using whore as an insult is retro. Many feminists today support sex workers and don't call them names either. Still, in other ways, WITCH was astonishingly modern. "If you are a woman and dare to look within yourself, you are a witch. You make your own rules. You are both free and beautiful. You can be invisible or evident in how you choose to make your witch self known," read the group's manifesto. "Whatever is repressive, solely male-oriented, greedy, puritanical, authoritarian, those are your targets. Your power comes from your own self as a woman, and it is activated by working together with your sisters." We can't argue with that. That's the kind of witchcraft this book is all about. A tarot ritual to attract friendship. Like a love spell, this ritual will not blindly bind someone to you, but make you the most attractive version of yourself. You'll use the symbolism of the tarot to channel your energy into your future relationships. What you'll need: a deck of tarot cards. Find them in bookstores, specialty shops, or online. A fancy goblet or cup of water. Remove the Three of Cups and the Sun from the tarot deck. The Sun, when upright, represents optimism, fulfillment, and the happiness that comes from being one's truest self. It symbolizes who you are in your friendship journey. The Three of Cups represents friendship, community, and the celebration of those things. It symbolizes where you want to wind up in your journey. Sitting on the floor, make a triangle with the cards and your body, with the Sun to your upper left and the Three of Cups to your upper right. Place the goblet of water in the middle of the triangle. Close your eyes and picture a strand of gold thread connecting you to the Sun, charging the card with all the attributes you'll bring to any new friendship. Then picture that thread extending from the Sun to the Three of Cups, taking your energy out into the community. Finally, join the thread from the Three of Cups back to you, so that the positive energy you put into the Sun is now flowing back to you through friendship. Sit for as long as you need to more clearly envision your future, in which you're opening yourself up to the world and receiving love and trust in return. When you're done, pick up the goblet and drink the water. Carry the two cards with you until you start making connections. The transformative power of vulnerability. Meeting new people, making overtures, and building familiarity take work. And once you've forged a friendship, you may be tempted to treat it like a fragile treasure. You get anxious about putting any kind of pressure on the relationship. After all, if it breaks, you have to start all over again. But you can't have a whole, true, nourishing friendship if you're frightened to ask for anything or show your darker side. Luckily, witches don't shy away from demons. They consort with them, not only bravely, but merrily. Members of a strong, supportive coven will help you figure out how to recognize your demons, resist their worst influences, and even dance alongside them. At the very least, your coven should be willing to invite your demons to happy hour. But there's no way to confront these agents of darkness without being open, honest, and vulnerable. Not all decent friendships delve into dark territory. But being able to admit to being scared, or sad, or uncertain, or hurt, or haunted by the past can add a special dimension to a friendship, and a romantic relationship. More on that in the next chapter. So, how do you start being vulnerable? Here are some ideas. Create space to summon demons without fear. At the heart of vulnerability is openness. A willingness to reveal yourself, but also to accept others. But even more important than sharing is listening. Don't overwhelm your friends by dumping problems on them. Show yourself to be a compassionate ear, a careful thinker, an active participant in cultivating a judgment-free environment. Think back to the rule of threes. The more openness you give to others, the more you'll receive when it's your turn to share. Join in the dance. Instead of hiding what you're going through, bring your demon to the party and see how that feels. Does being open about a personal struggle overwhelm your group and suck all the air out of the room? Or can all of you look the demon in the eye and help each other not to flinch? Challenge yourself to acknowledge negative thoughts and feelings instead of merely sweeping them under the rug. Find your demon's true names. This part of vulnerability is less about figuring out how to formally address your demons and more about exploring their nature. Learning to name your demons is more about recognizing their true nature. Vulnerability doesn't mean just blurting out complaints. I'm sad. I'm lonely. What you said made me angry. My knee hurts. It means exploring and sharing the reasons behind your anger, sadness, and pain. When that's hard to do alone, an insightful friend should be able to help. Be sincere, flexible, and willing to entertain multiple causes of and solutions to your problems. Opening up about a problem, but then sneering at every proposed solution is not vulnerability. That's just bitching. Resist the allure of wallowing and mistreatment. Sometimes sharing your darkest, ugliest struggles can rebound in unfortunate ways. Your friend might enable further toxic thinking instead of helping you banish it, or she might simply be careless with your secrets. Don't kick yourself too hard. The process of opening up, regardless of the outcome, will help you learn to look your demons in the face and, eventually, dance with them on your own. A collaborative ritual to deepen friendship. Good friends create happy memories, but also understand your sadness and secrets without judgment. This ritual celebrates all the many aspects at the heart of friendship. What you'll need: a collection of objects, a cigar box or other small container. This ritual requires prep work by both you and your friend. Before you meet, meditate on difficult memories, personal traumas, anxieties, perceived flaws, and secrets you want her to understand. We're calling your friend her, but these friendship spells work with friends of all genders. Then find or make a small token to represent each of these experiences or qualities. Create small artworks, or find inexpensive objects to represent your secrets. For example, a plastic ring could symbolize your worry about finding a life partner. A playing card could represent fear that your success is due to luck instead of skill. Or a dry leaf could indicate anxiety about aging. Collect 6 to 8 of these and put them in the box. Have your friend do the same. Meet your friend in a quiet, comfortable, familiar place with your boxes. Explain to her what each item in the box represents, then have her do the same for her items. Then present your box to her, saying, "I give you my sadness, not as a burden, but as a gift." When your friend accepts the box, she should say, "I accept your sadness, not to cure, but to protect." Then repeat the exchange with your friend's box of secrets. For the following week, contemplate the items in your friend's collection. Think about happy memories you've shared or future plans. Create a new association for each item she's given you. For example, the plastic ring could be a reminder of a fun shopping trip at a flea market. The playing card could symbolize your shared love for Alice in Wonderland, and the dry leaf could represent your upcoming hiking adventure. When a week has passed, meet your friend again in the same place. Tell her the new meanings you've devised for her objects, then have her do the same for your objects. Present your friend's box of secrets, now a box of happy thoughts, back to her, saying, "I give you what we share together, though I still protect your sadness in my heart." When your friend accepts the box, she should say, "I accept this as a treasure, though our bonds are both light and dark." Repeat the exchange with the other box. Keep your original box, which now contains both your shared vulnerabilities and happiness, in a safe place in your home. Which pet should be your familiar? Cat. Pros: low maintenance, fuzzy, doesn't give a shit about anyone's opinions. Cons: sharp, weird, doesn't give a shit about your opinions. Dog. Pros: unconditional love, can learn tricks, extreme power over emotions. Cons: sorta dumb, totally filthy, will absolutely betray you to your enemies. Guinea pig. Pros: squeaks adorably, tolerates costumes, can easily hide while spying on people for you. Cons: no good for sawdust allergies, not good pack animals, Soulless eyes. Cockatiel. Pros: tiny dinosaur. Can fly. Totally punk rock. Cons: tiny dinosaur. Can be a jerk. Difficult to walk. Snake. Pros: smells with its tongue and that's badass. Scales: as venomous as my heart. Cons: walks with its abs and that's weird. Not all are venomous. Phallic. Manatee. Pros: huggable, often mistaken for mermaids, body positive. Cons: confined to the water, illegal to touch in Florida. But don't touch anything in any state without its consent. Healing friends for fun and profit. How to channel your inner wise woman. Emotional work, like listening, thinking, and advising, is work, though often we think of it as just part of friendship or just something women like to do. But donating comfort and solace to a friend is a labor of love, just like knitting a sweater or making a pie. The healers and wise women, who were later called witches, recognized the value of this effort. Their life's mission was to look after the physical and emotional health of their community, after all. But although they might have been able to cure a broken heart with a potion, or devise a ritual to ease someone's nerves, or concoct a salve for sadness, they also expected fair compensation. When a friend comes to you with a problem, you can imagine yourself as the village wise woman or healing crone. A young woman of the community has approached you with her problem, heartbreak, say. She has braved difficulties traveling to your hut, which is far from the village, maybe even in a perilous place, and she feels ashamed of anyone knowing that she's there or why. But she knows she's hurting and will take some risks to find help. She has brought payment, though not necessarily money. She knows she doesn't owe you something just because she's in need. How would the village witch handle such a request? Affirm the difficulty of seeking help. As we've seen earlier in the chapter, admitting to another person that you're in pain is often a tremendous act of will, and the path to relief isn't always straightforward. Don't judge your friend for needing your healing, and don't expect her to be able to tell you exactly what she needs. Helping her figure that out is part of the service you can provide. Recognize the healing value you possess. Often when someone is in pain, our first instinct is to say something like, "I wish there were something I could do." That may be good-hearted, but it's also dismissive, because there is something you can do. Listen, keep her company, help her think or plan or laugh or grieve. Use the magic words. Do you want advice or do you want to vent? Would it help to talk more about what happened? What do you plan to do next? Do you need someone to go with you? Modern cures for emotional ills. Potions and tinctures. Let your friend tell you her troubles over tea, cocoa, or cocktails. You're buying. A familiar. Invite a sad friend to play with your pets, or act as a familiar yourself by accompanying her to do an emotionally difficult task. Curses and laughter spells. Depending on your friend's situation, she may be aided by you expressing your anger alongside her, or by you helping her to laugh and forget her troubles. If you're not sure which, ask. Objects of power. Thoughtful gifts and care packages sent to a distant friend are a way to help from afar. Advice, but not scolding or lectures. If you're not sure whether advice is welcome, you can always ask first. Consider your price. You don't owe anyone free emotional labor, but you can offer the people you love a special deal. Before offering to help, consider how much it requires from you. Will you need to accompany this person somewhere? Make a difficult phone call for them? Help them draft a tricky letter? And how much you're likely to get in repayment. Gratitude, seeing them happy, similar help from them in the future? If your assistance is grossly out of proportion with the likely payback, that's a good way to breed exhaustion and resentment. So, offer all you reasonably can, and no more. Don't think of yourself as wise enough to be the village wise woman. Don't let that stop you. If a friend comes to you for help, she probably considers you a healer, even if you don't identify as an expert in emotional health. After all, the village wise women were hardly licensed therapists. The important thing is to put in the effort, and to recognize that helping does take effort, that it's a kind and difficult thing you can do for a friend. A spell for establishing boundaries. In this ritual, a magic protective circle symbolizes the boundaries that keep you safe within your friendship. What you'll need: at least 10 index cards, a pen, chalk or salt, a small cup of water if you're using chalk, 2 folders or envelopes. Magic depends on harmony and balance, and a harmonious friendship requires balance between vulnerability and boundaries. Boundaries protect you in relationships that become emotionally unsafe, carry obligations, or take up more time and energy than you can spare. As you get closer with a friend, you will likely find that your boundaries shift. The protective circle is a simple piece of magic popular among practicing witches, and is, of course, a boundary. Whether you encounter malign forces or just need an area to concentrate and feel safe, the protective circle creates an energy space that can't be broached, even by you, until you've symbolically opened a doorway. You can return to this ritual again and again as your relationship develops. Perform this ritual in a room where the floor is easy to clean. Concrete, tile, or linoleum are all good surfaces. On each index card, write or draw one thing that a friend might ask of you, either with her or on your own. Come up with at least 10 asks, trying for a mix of ones that push your boundaries and others that don't. Some ideas for friendship activities that usually don't push boundaries: sharing triumphs and joys, going to a movie together, celebrating a birthday, discussing favorite books. Some ideas for friendship activities that not everyone wants to do with every friend: talking on the phone, discussing your sex lives, discussing your diets, expressing sadness or trauma, texting frequently, doing personal grooming, like waxing, appointments together. You can focus on a particular friend, tailoring your choices to your friendship, or practice the ritual for general boundary setting, sticking to generic requests and friend favors. With the chalk or the salt, make a circle on the ground at least 3 feet in diameter. As you draw, say these words: what I invite into my heart, let me invite it into this circle. What I remove from this circle, let me protect my heart against it. Stand or sit in the center of the circle. Look at each index card, one at a time, picturing yourself doing the activity with another person, or the particular friend if your ritual is specific to one person. Notice how you feel. If contemplating the card makes you feel joyful, excited, or another positive emotion, place it on the ground inside the circle. Otherwise, place it outside the circle. When you have contemplated all the cards, open a door in your friendship circle by washing away some of the chalk with the water, or by brushing away some of the salt. As you open the door, say these words: let my heart remain open even as I protect myself. Let me protect myself even as my heart remains open. You may now leave the circle. Collect the 2 piles of cards and store them in separate folders or envelopes. You can revisit them when you need to remind yourself of your boundaries, and you can repeat the ritual as many times as you want. Witch history. Why witches dance naked in the woods. Scandalous rumors of women cavorting with each other in the dark have long accompanied accusations of witchcraft. Although nakedness wasn't considered inherently sinful in the Middle Ages, it also symbolized innocence or youth. It was regarded as outside the norm, enough to be plausible evidence of consort with the devil. Early illustrations and texts depict witches anointing their naked bodies in order to fly. The Malleus Maleficarum said witches have often been seen lying on their backs in the fields or the woods, naked up to the very navel, appearing to have sex with invisible demons. By the 1800s, European artists realized that a bunch of naked women dancing madly in the middle of the night was dynamite subject material for a painting, especially if you wanted to paint, well, a bunch of naked women, and created tableaus where the witches in question looked less like withered, shameful crones and more like voluptuous, rosy-faced babes, albeit babes flying around with fire-eyed bat demons. Other depictions of the witches' sabbat include in the buff dancing, sex, and cannibalism, each act as sinful as the next. But for witches, ritual nudity isn't about sex. It's about freedom. The 1899 book Aradia, or The Gospel of the Witches, an influential text in the 20th century witchcraft movement, explains it this way. "And as the sign that ye are truly free, ye shall be naked in your rites, both men and women also." The practice of naked rites, or going skyclad, was later embraced by Gerald Gardner, one of the founders of Wicca. Modern witches practice ritual nudity to get as close as possible to the earth and spirits. It's also a way to signify faith. For sky-clad covens, skin is the livery of the goddess. It is their Sunday or Sabbath best, according to a witch's Bible. Also, like showing up to church or synagogue, no matter what you're wearing, naked group dancing is about community. Praying from home is fine, but putting on, or taking off, a nice dress and meeting up with your peers gives your spiritual practice extra resonance. Worshipping the Moon with Shine Theory. In a 2013 New York Magazine article, writer Anne Friedman coined the term shine theory, the idea that when remarkable women surround themselves with other remarkable women, we make each other shine more brightly. The idea seems almost counterintuitive. We are taught to be wary of other women outshining us, and this anxiety fuels everything from slam books to corporate backstabbing to hideous bridesmaid dresses with giant bows on the butt. But it's rooted in an idea of false scarcity, a Highlander-style conviction that for one woman to succeed, all others must fail. Helping one another shine is important to witches, who have long found the moon, associated with spirituality, magic, and feminine power, symbolically significant for similar reasons. It's reflective, not incandescent, but it's no less beautiful or important for relying on borrowed light. It may not be a gigantic nuclear furnace, but nobody would say that the moon doesn't shine. And on bright moonlit nights, it allows water to shine too, and grass, and windows, and trees. If there's snow on the ground, the shine can be bright enough to read by. If you believe that you have to fight other women for the hottest guy, the token woman spot on the board, or the queen bee social role, you are turning away from the shine. A man who encourages you to insult or betray other women is hardly a prize. A company that refuses to hire more than one woman is bound to be toxic. The social capital of a queen bee pales in comparison to an entire coven of bright, creative, synergistic, supportive pals. Embracing the light in other women expands options for everyone. Shine theory encourages us to realize that there is enough success and happiness and confidence and love to go around. That, in fact, there's more of it when women support each other. If you are stuck in the habit of competing and comparing, Try going outside on a clear night during a full moon for a Shine Theory ritual. Imagine yourself surrounded by friends, each of you softly glowing in the moonlight. Speak this incantation aloud to each imagined friend in turn until it feels natural and easy. I'm so proud of you. I'm lucky to know you. I'm lucky I get to be your friend. You may also want to bring a talisman to charge with the feeling of being bathed in reflected light, or a jar or vial in which to collect some of the moonlight and help keep the feeling going. A spell to ditch friend envy. This spell will help you expel jealous thoughts from your mind while focusing your energies on the positive. What you'll need: 2 pieces of paper, one larger than the other, a pen or pencil, light blue and yellow crayons or colored pencils. Despite our best intentions to be bright, shining moons for each other, even the most generous people sometimes succumb to friend envy. Maybe your friend is doing better in school or in her career than you feel you are. Maybe she's dating someone you liked first, or dating while you're single. Maybe her hair looked amazing on a day when you woke up feeling bad about yourself. How dare she? Addressing this totally normal jealousy will help both of you get your glow back. On the small piece of paper, write down what your friend has that you want. Be as specific as possible. Instead of just writing a boyfriend, for example, dig a little deeper. Why do you envy her relationship? Because you want to feel loved and appreciated? Because you want to know that someone has your back? Because you just want to borrow a big comfy sweatshirt? On the larger piece of paper, list everything you have that brings joy to your life. Be as broad or specific as you want. The ability to appreciate beauty is just as good as that endearing little hair below my belly button. Envision 2 energy bubbles of equal size, a green one containing envy and a pink one containing joy. Read the list on the larger piece of paper out loud 3 times. As you speak each item, picture the green bubble shrinking and the pink bubble expanding and crowding it out. Fold the small piece of paper into as tiny a square as you can make and place it inside the larger one. Fold the larger piece of paper into a square around it. Then use the crayons to decorate this little feelings packet, light blue for tranquility and understanding, yellow for breaking down mental blocks. Scribble nonsense doodles, spell out words, sketch a detailed image, whatever your feelings inspire. As you draw, imagine your bitterness draining from you with every stroke, leaving only the belief that you and your friend deserve good things. Close your eyes, take a few deep breaths, and thank yourself for taking the time to care for yourself. Keep the package in a safe place until your envious feelings dissipate. A spell to let go of a friendship. Based on the spell from A Witch's Bible, designed to bring 2 people closer together, this spell encourages 2 people to drift apart peacefully. What you'll need: a pen or pencil, 1 chess piece that you feel represents you, 1 chess piece that you feel represents the other person. Friendship feels precious. Sure, humans make connections every day, but bonding with a person who gets you, who accepts you for your weird or silly or sour self, is some of the strongest magic out there. So it's natural to feel wistful when a friendship wanes. Maybe one or both of you did something unforgivable to the other. Maybe you've grown apart, or your interests and values have changed. Or maybe neither of you has been making an effort, and when you think about it, you realize neither of you minds. After a romantic breakup, we have a cultural script to follow. We call friends, we mope, we eat ice cream, and slowly look for love again. But there is no script for how to react to a friend breakup. Sometimes it makes sense to talk about these changes with your friend, so you can accept what's happening and maybe salvage part of the friendship. But other times, ghosting might make the most sense. We can't tell you what will work for your circumstance. We just know that, whatever it is, a ritual to bid farewell to that relationship never hurts. With the pen, scratch or write each of your names on the bottom of the respective chess pieces and place them next to each other on the center of a shelf. While placing one hand on each piece, close your eyes and recite the following three times. It is time to say goodbye. We will each move forward. Thank you for what you have given me. Each day for 7 days, recite the incantation and move the pieces a little farther apart, so that after a week they are on opposite ends of the shelf. Then thank each piece for what it has done, and put them away. Chapter 5. Enchantment. The power to make choices about love and sex. Unabashed sexuality has always been part of a witch's terrifying power. The witch danced naked, she consorted with lusty demons, she had untrammeled appetites. She took control of her reproduction and helped other women do the same. She rode around on a broomstick, if you know what we mean. Today, women who are secure in, happy about, and in full command of their sexuality are still regarded with suspicion. Our right to control our bodies, from who we want to sleep with to whether we want to get pregnant, is as much a political battleground as it ever was. You're a lot less likely to get burned at the stake, but you're still up against some persistent punishing attitudes about sex. Slut is a common insult. Affirmative consent is still somehow a contentious concept. Rape survivors too often are dismissed, even demonized, because of what they were wearing when they were attacked, or what kind of social lives they have. But the power of the witch, the power of the unruly woman who laughs at society's rules, is also the power to transcend all this nonsense by believing unshakably in her right to sexual and romantic expression. We can't tell you how to make everyone else respect your choices, but we can help you respect your own choices so strongly that you don't care what they think. It can be hard to home in on your own needs and desires with everyone else's expectations whirling around. Whether you love sex or shrug about it, or are somewhere in between, at some point you'll either date or be asked why you aren't dating. You'll sleep with those dates, or decide you don't want to. You'll meet people who want to sleep with you and decide how you feel about that. You'll be in a relationship or stay single. You'll fall in love or you won't. In all these cases, your inner witch can help get you through. Conjuring your perfect mate. Dating often feels less like looking for someone who has exciting qualities and more like systematically ruling out anyone who doesn't, especially now that Tinder's a thing. No shirt, swipe left. Dumb name, swipe left. Loves to laugh, swipe left. Ugh, beard, swipe left. But in our hyper-vigilant search for red flags, does he list only male authors on his OkCupid profile? Does she hate dogs? Does he smoke? We sometimes forget to pay attention to what we do want. It's not enough to know what you won't put up with. You also have to know what might make you happy. Take it from a couple of ladies who goofed up a few times before finding love. A person, and not wrong for me, is emphatically not the same as the right person for me. This is where positive visualization can make a huge difference. By now you know that stating your desires out loud, or at least on paper, is a powerful way to manifest your will in almost every situation. Conjuring up a mate, or date, is no exception. If you find yourself constantly compromising in love, looking for someone without many problems, instead of someone with the ability to fill you with joy, you can benefit from the time-honored technique of conjuring a lovingly detailed imaginary friend. Jess accidentally discovered this method of attracting romantic connection about a million years ago when she was 22 and in love with someone emotionally unavailable. tired of banging her head against that particular wall, she wrote a truly exhaustive description of a hypothetical ideal mate. He reads everything and remembers the facts and the words he reads well enough to use them in conversation. He's smarter than I am in a field I find interesting. When I initially overreact to something he says that pushes my buttons, he doesn't immediately counter my defensiveness and turn it into an actual argument. He has a way of making me calm down, step back, and be rational without making me feel like a basket case. He likes doing nice things for me, and he's willing to ask for help when he needs it. But he doesn't take advantage of or take for granted the fact that I like doing nice things for him. He asks my advice on things and then listens. He gives me advice, but not until I ask. He's devoted to his friends. He calls his mom. He's incredibly funny, sardonic, great with wordplay, great deadpan. He knows how to do playful antagonism. He's just generally playful, but he doesn't make jokes that are actually at my expense. He's excited about the things he loves, but he's not a particularly driven person, and he doesn't get worked up easily. He often has good ideas for something to do, but sometimes he just wants to curl up together, and he'll say so. Then she asked her friends to help give him a name, and she wound up calling him Park. No idea why. Naming her desired partner and enumerating what she wanted from him helped put things in sharp perspective. Every so often, she would look at her current unsuitable real-life fellow, really look at him, and think, well, he's no Park. She knew that flings, fun as they were, didn't have to go anywhere because, well, they were no Park. And when she finally found the right relationship, the one that felt good everywhere, she looked back at the description she'd written more than a decade before and thought, holy shit, this guy is Park. Jess's friend Kirsten hilariously calls making such a list the Build-A-Boy Workshop. This method isn't literal magic, of course. Detailed contemplation won't conjure your ideal beloved out of thin air. What this exercise can do is remind you that your ideal beloved should be more than just a warm body who isn't too mean to you. And by training your focus on the specific qualities you want, you'll naturally keep your eyes open for their manifestation in the real world, which will, eventually, help you summon that kind of person into your life. Here's how to get started. Go deep. As you list the positive qualities of your ideal partner, try to go deeper than superficial traits. Rather than all the favorites you and your partner have to have in common, favorite band, favorite book, favorite food, etc., focus on values or emotional traits instead. In other words, don't be like Teen Jaya, whose ideal partner had the same favorite band, but different favorite songs by that band. You know, so they weren't too similar. Needless to say, this person never showed up. Think about what you truly value, not just what you like. Interview your imagination. Don't know how to divine the meaningful qualities of your ideal partner? Imagine the questions you'd ask at a low-key interview for the position of my significant other, such as, how do they respond when they disagree with their partner, and when their partner disagrees with them? What kinds of activities do they prioritize? What is their preferred relationship with other friends, with family? What personal life goals are important to them? What does success mean for them? What about happiness? Know how you want to be loved. Not everyone shows love the same way. Some people like to have heart-to-heart conversations, give compliments, and otherwise express affection with words. Others like to do favors, buy thoughtful gifts, and perform actions that make life easier for their beloved. When you get involved with someone who expresses love in a different way from you, you may feel smothered or abandoned and pressured to either vilify your partner, he never buys me presents, what an asshole, or convince yourself to ask for less. She doesn't express love verbally, so I just have to do without hearing I love you, even though that makes me feel anxious and lonely. It's important to be open to your partner's ways of expressing love, but it's also okay to need what you need. When you envision your ideal mate, consider what makes you feel loved and cared for. Compliments and verbal affirmation, cuddling and physical affection, pampering when you feel down. Sometimes it's embarrassing to admit what we need, but stay firm. Which hearts want what they want? Being upfront with yourself about how you express and experience love will help you recognize people who operate the same way as you, and help you stay compassionate and communicative if you fall for someone who operates differently. Don't get too dreamy. Like many powerful forms of magic, there's a flip side to this conjuring practice. Resist the urge to become so absurdly devoted to this imaginary person that real people have no hope of measuring up. Instead, let the ideal partner act as a beacon, a reminder that good enough isn't good enough, that you can move towards something you truly want instead of merely dodging the worst. A spell to focus on what you want. If you're having a hard time figuring out what matters to you in a romantic relationship, this spell will help you focus on the positive feelings you hope to get from a potential partner. What you'll need: a bathtub or your bed, 4 small pieces of paper, a comfortable glove or shoe, a piece of food you find delicious. You can do this ritual anytime, but it works especially well if you have a date coming up. Fill the bathtub and immerse yourself, or lie in the bed. Focus on the sensation of being cradled and supported. Get out of the bath and dry off, or get up from the bed and repeat the following incantation. As now, so forever. As alone, so with others. After you've said the incantation, fold 1 piece of paper 3 times to seal that feeling. Put on the glove or shoe. Focus on how it fits comfortably without constricting, chafing, or binding. Repeat the incantation, and then fold the 2nd piece of paper to seal the feeling. Do 7 jumping jacks, or 7 sit-ups, or 7 cartwheels, or 7 reps of whatever physical activity is comfortable for you. Focus on the sense of being energized and excited. Repeat the incantation a 3rd time and fold the 3rd piece of paper. Slowly eat the food. Focus on the feeling of being pleased and nourished. Repeat the incantation 1 last time and fold the final piece of paper. After the date, or the next day if you don't have a date planned, hold the folded pieces of paper between your hands close to your heart. Contemplate the feelings of support, comfort, energy, and pleasure that you are able to access on your own. Consider whether you experience these same feelings when in the presence of the other person, or whether any conflicts prevent you from being supported, comfortable, energized, or happy in the ways you are by yourself. Keep the papers inside a diary or favorite book so you can check in with these feelings in the future. The waxing and waning of desire. What to do when you don't want to have sex. Some witches believe in white and black magic not as performances of good and evil, but as representations of magical energy. White magic is done when your energy is high, when you feel loved and happy and fulfilled, and it creates more of those feelings in the world. Black magic is performed out of fear and anger, a final thrashing of panic in order to survive, and it creates more fear and uncertainty. This has to do with sex, we promise. When Jaya was 12, she felt like the last person in the world who hadn't kissed anyone. Her friends had started going on dates and were making out in movie theaters, and, once they realized she was being left out, they huddled together and schemed over which boy they could convince to initiate her, which basically made her want to die. Jaya would eventually get her first kiss, and many more, but what plagued her then wasn't just that nobody seemed to want to kiss her. It was that, if she really thought about it, She didn't feel like kissing either. There was a bud of sexuality inside her, and she knew that someday it would bloom. But she wasn't ready for sex. Not yet. And she found it annoying as hell that her friends thought that was weird. Growing up, most of us are bombarded with conflicting messages about sexual behavior.